This is Nuke Joss from the Nutty Bites Podcast, and you are splishing and splashing and listening to Tales from the Tub.
Happy Halloween from the Bathtub Mermaid. Tonight, I have four stories for you. The first, read by my friend Clay, is called Chalk.
Stephen loved to walk from his tiny garret apartment overlooking the river to the university where he taught. His first class was a geography section that met at 7:10 every morning. Most of the year, that meant his walk was illuminated by the first warming rays of the morning sun. He would walk the first segment along the river, where fog often diffused the colors of the sunrise. Then he would turn towards the center of the city. Stopping at his favorite newsstand for the daily paper, he reveled in the inky texture of the newsprint against his fingers, a coffee, and a cheese Danish. His lunches and dinners were always healthy, but having coffee and pastry in the morning had been a ritual since his student days, when eating on the go had been more important than balanced nutrition. Besides, his daily walks, rain or shine, warm weather or cool, kept him trim. He could afford the empty calories. The last portion of Stephen's walk brought him through the chalk alleys. These were narrow streets between great brick buildings, their external walls covered in layer upon layer of chalk drawings. He enjoyed the work of the different artists. And while he could never decipher the tags that represented their creators' names, he recognized each distinct style. There was one chalk artist who was obsessed with machine-age cityscapes, and another who thought themselves a contemporary Degas, covering walls with stylized dancers in modern club attire. There was the illustrator who memorialized local personalities on the bricks, and there was another who created trompe-l'oeil windows onto other worlds. More recently, however, a new artist had joined the extant crew. Stephen had glimpsed some of their work on the warehouses along the waterfront and became intrigued by the monsters they depicted. A white shark with three-dimensional teeth swam on the wall of the old boathouse, and a dragon with scales that glittered like stars on the wall opposite the university gates. Creature features, Stephen's private nickname for the skilled creator, monsters were all based on real animals, but given heightened realism and exaggerated danger. As he turned the final corner, Stephen saw Creature Features' most recent work, a giant squid that seemed to undulate along the wall, several of its tentacles even curling around the corner of the building. In the weak light that hit these bricks, it seemed as if the squid was following him on his path. Indeed, when he turned the corner, the tentacles followed him, stretching off their flat surface to reach for... No, this could not be happening! Stephen quickened his pace in order to reach the next corner where he could cross the street and climb the stairs to the pedestrian bridge. The great beast followed him. It made no sound, but when Stephen had to step closer to the wall to sidestep a puddle, he caught the scent of seawater and something faintly rubbery and slimy and sinister, and felt the sucker on the tentacle's underside brush the back of his neck. Dropping his coffee and pastry, Stephen broke into a run. Most of his brain was occupied with breathing and not tripping and wishing he thought to wear running shoes to work and change upon arrival, but another, smaller part wondered if any of his students followed this route to school, and if so, what would they think? The sunlight grew brighter, bringing more of the brick expanse into its warming glow, and Stephen cast aside his newspaper and ran faster. If he could reach that corner, he'd be out of the shadows. Surely sunlight would stop the thing, right? Right? But he'd forgotten. Just before the corner, one of the old buildings had been supplanted by a skyscraper, as was happening more and more often in the city. The tall structure blotted out the sunlight, and the squid reached for him again, and this time, the suckers caught him. As the chalk creature dragged him into its dusty embrace, why had he thought it was slimy? Stephen screamed, but there was no one to hear him. The seasons changed. Stephen's class was reassigned, to the bewilderment of the students who had always enjoyed their original professor's lectures. The landlord eventually emptied his apartment and leased it to someone new at twice the rent. Rains erased the cityscapes and dancers, and new illustrations came to create new chalk pictures. But the squid, on its sheltered bricks, remained. It wasn't technically indelible, but no one was willing to touch it. The vibe was too weird, they said. They didn't even want to use the empty bits of wall on either side. Still, the image of the giant sea monster had been altered. If asked, people would say the image changed around the time of Stephen's disappearance. And the alteration? The figure of a man, in khaki pants and a jacket with elbow patches, a messenger bag slung across his body, was visible in the curl of one of the squid's tentacles, his mouth open in a perpetual scream.
This next story is a twist on an old myth about the Fates. It's read by Nuke Joss, and it's called Clock Watcher.
They call her the Unturnable because she will not change her mind. Once someone has reached the end of their allotted thread, she whisks in to snip it. They call her the inevitable one, the inflexible. Rarely do they use her name, Atropos. Most times, the cut is a gentle one. She catches her charge as their weight is untethered from the cable holding them to life. Sometimes, she misses the catch, and there is a metaphysical thud as though a weary soul has collapsed to a less than ethereal floor. People feel her, but her calling is a necessary one. Time and technology have changed how she works. Over the years, decades, centuries, and epochs, her sisters have changed their methods as well. Clotho was excited to be able to use a 3D printer to create lives rather than merely spinning them. And Lachesse was immediately taken with any number of Rube Goldberg-esque measuring devices involving chutes and troughs and scoops and bins and rolling pins that bounce and glide. The middle sister always had been a bit of a tinkerer. And for Atropos herself, somewhat ironically, the unturnable one had become enamored with the turning hands of clocks. A clock for each of her charges, each of her targets, every living soul with the correct allotment, as prescribed by Lachesse and created by Clotho. Pre-programmed into the perfect number of ticks and tops or bleeps or blinks, some of the clocks were digital. They didn't chime hours, these clocks, but showed how a thread would be snipped. The shears were merely a symbol now. There were so many other ways in the world. Look at that one. It's got lots of time left before the hours wind down to doesn't wake up. Or that one over there, just a few minutes left before it chimes old age. But then there are some more ominous clocks. The ones with darker ways. Those are the lives that are tortured and broken. Some are sad, some are angry, some have been harmed, some wish to cause harm. Some wish to take others' lives with them when they go. Some wish only for their own endings. An Atropos is the clock watcher who sees them all. Tick-tock, it's half an hour till poison. Tick-tock, it's a quarter to gun. They call her the unturnable, but some clocks she wishes she could turn back.
If you haven't guessed yet, Clay is sort of my featured performer tonight. This next story, also read by him, is called Wind and Water.
He'd been reluctant to bring her to the farm. The prairie was so far from the ocean she loved, and confining her to a landlocked life seemed somehow cruel. The night before they left California, she took him to Half Moon Bay. She stripped off her clothes, and while he watched, she stepped into the freezing Pacific. He was half convinced she'd be eaten by a shark. A surfer had been attacked just a few days before. He was worried the undertow would claim her, and their marriage would be over before it had really begun. But after 15 minutes, she had come walking back out of the frothy, foamy waves, her skin glowing in the light of the full moon. He tried to wrap her in the thick towel they brought, but she demurred. "Hold this, please," she requested, drawing a blue glass bottle from her beach bag. He did, and she squeezed the salt water from her dark hair into the waiting vessel. Then she wrapped the towel around them both and pushed him onto the scratchy wool blanket she'd inherited from her grandfather. He was a sea captain, she told him once. He spoke the language of the wind and the waves. But in that moment, the only wind was a balmy one blowing across the beach, and the only waves he cared about weren't the ones crashing a few yards away, but the ones he was riding as she rode him. She'd adapted to prairie life more easily than he'd expected. She had a green thumb, and her tomatoes won raves at the county fair. So did her strawberry rhubarb pies. "I never knew," she told him, "what they meant when they talked about pie plant in the Little House books until I came here, to think it was only ever rhubarb." At night, they'd light citronella candles and sit on the porch and watch the stars wheel around in the sky. Well, she'd watch the stars. He'd watch the wind as it ruffled her hair and her skirts. The wind was a constant presence in the prairie. He'd warned her about it, told her that in the old days, before electrical hum and technology drowned the sound and provided distractions, people literally went mad from the never-ceasing wind. But she just laughed and teased the nape of his neck. "I like the wind," she said. "If I close my eyes, it sounds like the ocean." For the most part, their life was happy. But sometimes he caught her staring at the blue bottle of ocean water, and he knew that a part of her was still in California. He might be her husband, but the ocean was her lover, and always would be. He asked if she wanted to move back, and she refused. "This is our home," she said. "I like it here." So they got a dog, and they added a room for her to write in, and a room for him to build model trains in, and a room they might, one day, give over to a child. The day the digital stick blinked pregnant, he came home to a strawberry rhubarb pie and homemade black bean chili and cornbread with fresh honey butter, and they went to the soft grass in the backyard and made love under the stars with a warm wind washing over them, and the stars smiling down. The day she started cramping and bleeding, the day they knew that room would never be a child's room, the wind had never been so fierce. He begged and pleaded with her to let him take her to the emergency room, but she'd seen the tiny fetal mass go down the toilet, a lima bean and a splash of blood, and said there was nothing emergent about it. She clutched her blue bottle and wept, and he wrapped himself around her and wept as well. He heard the shatter of glass and went to check on her, expecting that she'd dropped a glass in the middle of the night. She never would turn the lights on when she went to get water. But it wasn't a glass. She was standing on the front porch with the door wide open and the fragments of her blue bottle at her feet. He heard a rushing sound, but it wasn't the wind he was accustomed to. Rather, it was a wall of water, a giant wave rushing towards them. "I would have taken you back to the sea," he told her. "I know," she said, "but it's too late. The sea is coming to take me back to it."
The last story tonight is one that I just wrote yesterday. It's called Bead by Bead, and it's sort of a gentle ghost story. For years, decades even, Mama Louise had been known for her beadwork. Every velvet bag, every fancy dress, every bridal gown in their small town had been hand-beaded by the old woman. Her work was impeccable, of course. She still used silk and cotton thread when commercial beadwork had switched to synthetics, or even glue. She never seemed to measure, but the spacing between her beads, whether it was simple trim or an intricate pattern, was always precise. Not a millimeter offset. Not a fraction of a millimeter in error. And when she was asked how she created these items of wearable art, Louise would smile and answer, "Bead by bead." More than her actual work was what Louise instilled in it. Before making a bag, Mama Louise would ask where it would be used, and she would have the eventual owner talk about their hopes and dreams for the event. The purse would then seem to carry the faintest scent of the floral archways of a specific restaurant, or glitter with the starlight of an open-air theater. If she were beading a dress for a ball or a party, Mama Louise would listen to the sort of music likely to be played there, and her old feet would tap out the rhythms as she worked. Somehow, her arthritic knees and ankles never objected to such movement. Later, the women who commissioned her work would share that their feet never seemed as light, their energy never seemed so strong. "I could have danced forever," one woman shared, glowing with happiness and enthusiasm. Bridal gowns had always been Mama Louise's specialty. She limited her commissions to 2 a year and quoted a 5-month turnaround. It was much longer than it took to have a custom gown from one of the bridal shops on Main Street, but her customers never objected. They knew that a dress from a store was just a dress, while a creation sewn by Louise would be a family heirloom. For those gowns, Louise would ask for stories of the bride's childhood. She would collect memories from her parents and friends, her cousins and sisters and partners in crimes and misdemeanors, which is how she jestingly referred to youthful exploits. She would also ask that each woman provide a well wish for the bride-to-be. When the recipient of such a gown finally tried it on, it would be as if each memory was whispering to her. And when she walked down the aisle on her special day to meet her partner at the end, She would feel the love of all the well wishes wrapping itself around her and sending her into a happy future. With so many girls and women being connected to Mama Louise through her work, it was inevitable that someone would notice when the old woman began work on another piece. But her most recent dress wasn't pure white like a bridal gown. It was buttery, like French vanilla. "Who is this piece for?" her visitors would ask. For it wasn't unusual for her clients to stop by with baked goods and have coffee or tea with Louise. "Is this a wedding dress?" But Louise wouldn't tell the recipient's name. Instead, she would lead the guest down memory lane, collecting a story of when that person had worn a creation by Louise. Bead by bead, this last dress was nearly finished. But work on it stopped suddenly when Louise had a heart attack one night. Her son was the one who found her. He was a quiet man, a concert violinist with elegant fingers. He could have done beadwork as fine as his mother's, but that wasn't where his heart had led him. An only child of an only child, he'd considered his mother's clients to be the sisters, cousins, and aunties he'd never had. "My mother," he said, "never sewed for herself, but this dress..." He choked up as he told the people who had gathered in the old woman's apartment. "This dress was meant to be her burial gown. She knew, I think, that her time was running out." There were 3 days until the wake and the funeral. 3 days to find a shop to finish the beadwork. Except Vanessa, the owner of Mama Louise's last wedding gown, came to sew on a few beads from her dress. And Caitlin, who owned no fewer than 6 of Louise's velvet handbags, brought 3 beads from each. The contributions continued. Each of her former clients added pieces of their favorite dresses and purses to the last few rows of beads on Mama Louise's death dress. Laughing together at their uneven rows, they shared memories and stories as they worked. They finished at midnight, the night before the wake, sitting back and sharing a collective sigh. Somehow, the soft breeze that wafted through Louise's living room didn't surprise them. It just felt right. Similarly, the appearance of their friend and neighbor in her rocking chair, looking peaceful if slightly transparent, was not scary, but somehow soothing. "We finished your dress," the women said. "We couldn't come close to your talent, but we tried to do the work with love." "And so you did," the ghost of their beloved friend shared in a thin voice. "Bead by bead, you finished the gown. Bead by bead, you strengthened your connections to each other and your community. Bead by bead, you spread love into the world." They wanted to hug her, but you can't hug a ghost. They wanted to share all their stories, but she was already fading. Still, she held up an ethereal hand and smiled her knowing smile. "I know all your stories," she said. "I know your hopes and dreams, and they will warm me into the next life. You've shared them with me, all of you, bead by bead." I hope you enjoyed tonight's offerings. The Bathtub Mermaid Tales from the Tub will be back in November with more stories. Meanwhile, here's a promo from Masterpiece Audio Theater.
"Space is claustrophobic in here. These are the characters of the Empad booth. Their continuing mission, to perform brand new scenes weekly in unpredictable combinations, to boldly challenge you like never before."
"Characters is irrelevant. Self-determination is irrelevant. You must comply. I am the runner of God. Resistance is futile. Your life, as it has been, is over. From this day forward, you will service us."
Come play Mad TV Mayhem Star Trek The Next Generation Edition. Episodes will drop weekly on Wednesday evenings at 8:30 p.m. Mountain Time. Points will be awarded for guessing the correct season and episode. Who will win the title? Who will win the grand prize? The voyage starts on October 30th. Come check us out for more details at nimlas.org. That's NIMLAS.ORG.
The Bathtub Mermaid, Tales from the Tub, is written and produced by Melissa A. Bartell and is recorded using the Auphonic iPhone app and Audacity. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 4.0 International License. This means you can share it with your friends or repost it as long as you credit me and link to my site. For show notes, including detailed credits and contact information, visit bathtubmermaid.com. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram as Melisse, M-E-L-Y-S-S-E. Thanks for listening, and remember, never let your bathwater get too cold.